We enter the modern period in the 1840s with the Industrial Revolution. And what's happening is that there are cities are growing because there's a factory base, and for the first time, people, particularly young adults, are leaving the farm and going to big cities to work in factories. And therefore, a new kind of culture develops in which young people, which is still happening today, in which young adults, particularly, are free from both family and small town social restrictions, and are freer in the anonymity of the big city to start living out who they are, start having relationships that are unchaperoned, start meeting other people who have alternative ideas to whatever was happening in their village, and they formed a new section of New York City called Greenwich Village. And these people were bohemians who had artistic tendencies and believed in free thinking and free love. We see we see Walt Whitman, who's a very gay poet, and talking about a new way of looking at relationships and between men and the a male spirituality, which, as in this feminist era, when old ways of being male are being called into question, Walt Whitman is an interesting person for us to go back to and look at what might be a positive male spirituality that's not identified with oppressing women. At the same time, we have Emily Dickinson, who is a lesbian poet and reflects the place of a woman in society, which Walt gets to go out and be a nurse for soldiers in the Civil War and have adventures. Emily, because she didn't get married, is kind of stuck at home and writes poetry. This industrialization kind of thing develops to the 1890s, when we have kind of the height of this first period. And of course, when we think of the gay 90s, we think of Oscar Wilde. Edward Carpenter is a less popularly known but very important figure in England, who develops the first kind of philosophy of the gay lesbian place in the world. At the same time, they're so out that the dominant society starts taking note of this, and there's no word for it. People just did what they did before. And so a sociologist named Havelock Ellis creates the word homosexuality in the 1890s. And we're moving into Western society in general is moving into a more and more secular framework in which scientific terms like homosexuality are created to talk about our world and our social reality in non-religious ways. At the same time, in these 1890s, we'll talk about language for a minute. We've got homosexuality as a term that's created by the authorities, in this case the medical authorities, to describe people. And it reduces us to, it really makes you always focus on sex when you hear that word, which is why we prefer gay and lesbian. And those terms are also having their emergence in this time. Someone's been asking me about why are non-gay people called straight? And in the second half of the 1890s, as this new urban culture emerged, gay and lesbian people, as they left the farm, and traveled to the big cities, found a community among theatrical people and bohemian people. And one of the euphemisms of that was the gay life. And people who were not in the gay life were straight. So those have very historic, you know, almost 200-year histories now. And until very recently, gay and lesbian life has continued to be a kind of underground, very rich but hidden subculture. The next focus, we talked about New York and England, with and the place where gay liberation really made its biggest strides in the first half of the 20th century was in Germany between the wars in Berlin. And a gay American author, Christopher Isherwood, went to Berlin because that's where it was happening, and he wrote Cabaret, which is a story of what was going on there. But more seriously than Cabaret, there was an important historical person named Magnus Hirschfeld, who's a German sociologist who was gay, and he formed the first modern real gay lesbian liberation organization. And they had a newspaper, and they were exploring what it means to be gay and what the common experience was. And they had a research center in Berlin. And this leads us right into the Holocaust, because when Hitler and the Nazis came into power, they had a mailing list. So they knew right where to go to find the people to put the pink triangles on. And this is still a very real part of gay and lesbian culture. And when you hear the debate going on about, in terms of AIDS, about whether testing should be anonymous, gay men are very leery about letting the state keep lists. Because the last time that happened, as Dan mentioned this morning, next to the Jews, we were the largest number of victims of the Holocaust. At the end of the war, we have films of American GIs liberating those concentration camps, letting out the Stars of David, pushing in back in to the concentration camps, the gay men. Pretty painful stuff to watch. 50s and 60s, we start seeing the civil rights movement for black people, and that moves us into the contemporary scene where, as the 60s progressed and liberation became a way of thinking about and empowering minority groups. And if you're as old as I am, you remember that the big transition that happened in consciousness when we stopped calling it the Negro problem and started identifying it as racism. When we stopped talking about the homosexual problem and started identifying it as homophobia and heterosexism. And in 1969, gay people fought back and organized. Gay men fought back and organized at Stonewall in New York. A parallel thing was happening with women. Rita Mae Brown, whose most recent work was the screenplay for Steel Magnolias, was part of NOW, the National Organization for Women, and she let the lesbians out and said, "You can't talk about feminism without talking about heterosexism as well." Yeah?
Could you talk about Stonewall? What is
Stonewall, which we're celebrating this week everywhere, and so you get to join us. There are parades, film festivals, things like that. This is kind of the Passover for gay and lesbian people. Stonewall was a little bar in Greenwich Village, where I think because gay culture tends to be hidden, sometimes I suppose people think of us as some kind of massive block of sameness or something. But there are communities of diversity within gay and lesbian people too, and bars tended to be, until that point, until 1969, the only place where these underground communities could meet. And the Stonewall was a bar that in the sense of a club, for drag queens, as they're called. Men who have fun dressing up as women. And Dan covered it pretty well at breakfast. These kind of bars were routinely, it was just harassment. You weren't breaking laws, but it was kind of like fun for a patriarchal society to persecute them, I guess. And they fought back, and much to the surprise of the police, and throwing their heels at them. The Greenwich Village, which is predominantly gay, rallied as the news spread that this was happening, and the riots continued for 3 days, and everyone joined in. And that's a point of rebellion which is commemorated now every June, usually the last Sunday in June, as the beginning of a new period of gay and lesbian history.
And you keep speaking louder.
Yes. And since that time, the gay and lesbian communities have increasingly come out of the closet. It's not such a bar-centered underground community anymore, although that's still a part of it, because we are still at risk at losing our jobs and getting kicked out of the church and so on and so forth. But more and more, the community has grown to form churches and social service agencies and theater groups, and there's quite a flourishing above-ground culture. I went to seminary in Berkeley and then worked for 5 years in the Castro neighborhood, and the Castro neighborhood of San Francisco is 30,000 gay men. So I could literally live without ever having to interact with straight people. My doctor was gay, my grocery store was gay, my church was gay, and all of that was just accepted there. I forgot one thing in this transition. While the Holocaust was going on in Germany, how this kind of started, the background before Stonewall, is that in a way that's sort of parallel to that first breakthrough in society in the 1840s, 50s, and 60s with the Industrial Revolution. In the 40s, we have the men all going off to war, women for the first time coming out of the home and working in factories again. And so there's a parallel there, and also social dislocation. And women were meeting each other, and lesbians could find out who each other were. And at the same time that was happening, there were purges in the arms, routine purges in the armed services of gay men. And they would be discharged from the service with a red H for homosexual stamped on their discharge card. And they were dumped in San Francisco from the Asian theater at Warp. And it was pretty hard to go back to Decorah, Iowa, or wherever, with the H that you had to use to get your foods here out. Ration stamps and so forth. So they stayed in San Francisco, and that's how San Francisco became a center for gay culture. And New York had an older history. All right, so how are we doing on time?
25 minutes.
Questions on this part? Yes.
In the Stonewall experience, did the straight community join in this protest and the harassment at
no.
the time? They did not. It was just a...
Yeah. I would say no. It's a very, still to this day, it's a very segregated community, so I would assume that they would be unaware of it going on, although Dan might know more.
No, I say, and the other part of that is the majority of the gay community didn't either. I mean, especially there had been a very slow movement for trying to get gay civil rights through all legal means and so forth, and folks who had worked for 20 years just trying to get people to say they were homosexual were scandalized at all these drag queens were out there rioting. It so oftentimes happens in social movements. It's the most oppressed within the oppressed who actually finally make things happen.
I was curious too, with they're always accusing the media of being so liberal, why there wasn't more of this empathetic information in the media when they're talking about the gay and lesbian issues. You know, I was here a couple years ago when Dan Spencer was talking, it was like, you know, gay and lesbian 101. But they still didn't talk about this background, and I'm curious why all we got was just the negative and not some of the more positive background about the gay and lesbian issues in the media. I just don't remember that coming across.
Part of what we're part of what this is about is as we learn these things, and gay and lesbian people learn their own history, also, is what comes into view is what homophobia and heterosexism is. You know, I mean, between college and seminary, I taught high school English, and I was teaching minority literature to seniors in high school, and it was Anita Bryant was out doing her thing. And I was very closeted because, of course, if I came out, I would get fired. But the irony of talking about women's literature and black literature and Chicano literature, and knowing that if I told my students that Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson and Thornton Wilder, who wrote Our Town, you know, were gay, who are like mainstream, you know, that I would be fired. Or that we can study Greek history and never, you know, no one ever tells us that Socrates is gay because that's going to undermine the morals of our youth. So all of this gets hidden and is not to be talked about, and we still face that today.
That's just outrageous.
Like, why, you know, one of the most common responses I hear in the church is, well, why do you have to talk about this?
Yeah, right.
You know, let's just not talk about it. So that's part of it. And it's still today. And so when Spirit of the Lakes came into the United Church of Christ, and incidentally, the United Church of Christ made its first call for civil rights in 1969, the same year as Stonewall. I'm proud of that. But when Spirit of the Lakes affiliated with the United Church of Christ, there was this, you know, huge conference, and the UCC is a very democratic congregational structure, so all the churches sent representatives, and they voted. And inside of the meeting, which we let the TV media in, there were 400 people who voted for us, celebrating this historic moment. Two people from a small town called Le Sueur, Minnesota, were upset.
The Green Giant,
yes. Were upset, and they went outside. And what we saw on the TV news Not one picture of the 400 people inside celebrating. We saw the two women outside crying and talking about homosexual Sunday school teachers who were going to molest their kids. You know, how does the media present this? What's the media predominant? And why do they do that? Part of it is they don't know this information either. Part of it is they're afraid that if they even do accurate reporting, the opposition will scare away their advertisers and then they won't make money. I mean, it's
talking authority again.
Yes.
The ultimate authority.
Definitely.
Over the news, whether it's printed or whether it's
authority. Other questions about historical context?
I said a question about language, and you said for gay and lesbian, and then as it referred to heterosexuals as straight, doesn't that term straight for you have a, I don't know, some sort of weird edge to it? Because if we're straight, then you're unstraight or something.
Could also mean narrow-minded.
And inexperienced. I mean, but I don't even think about. We have worse terms for you.
Where do we get a list of those?
One of my favorite is breeders. but. I think, you know, words take on their own feeling the more you use them and stuff. And I just say that word without, I don't stop and think about it. The community is aware of what you're saying, and there's a tendency in more like public and official kinds of documents or speeches or something to refer to non-gay people, which places, you know, something about personal location, and also, I don't know, does that feel less pejorative to you? And maybe someday we won't have to have these labels, because we'll be in heaven, all we want. Well,
this has been a very fascinating and helpful history. Apart from buying the tape, is there a book, or where do you go for this kind of information? I mean, ignorance is obviously not blissful.
Well, the John Boswell book is good, particularly if you're seminary trained. It's kind of technical. But since I am, I don't know how inaccessible it is.
It's really dense.
It's very dense.
Very dense.
Okay. He's got a new book coming out, incidentally. Somehow the Vatican, didn't know who he was or something. And they let him into the Vatican archives, and he has found... Oh, Yale, great. He's found marriage liturgies in the Catholic Church from 300 to about 900 AD, and they've never been taken off the books, so in Catholicism, tradition has equal weight to scripture. So when he publishes this book, it's going to be fun to see what Vatican does. Gay American History is good. I don't know, does anyone else have a resource that's fun and readable?
Well, part of the problem is it's all available in pieces. There's no comprehensive survey. But there's a couple excellent ones about the Holocaust, one called The Men with the Pink Triangles. It has Holocaust survivors, gay men, telling their stories about what happened, both before and then during the Holocaust. There's also a brand new book out that really is very good for the U.S. experience called Coming Out Under Fire by Alan Berube, who is, that's that right there.
Alan Berube is the source of that information I gave you about American GIs and women in factories, and that's close enough, and he's a good enough historian that he's spent 8 years doing oral histories with people. And it's a fascinating.
And it reads very easily. It's a very narrative one. It's brand new, 1990, but it traces the rise of the gay and lesbian movement starting from World War II up to current.
Another.
Excuse me, how do you spell Berube?
Berube.
And I have that book here if anybody's interested in looking at it.
Want it on the board?
Yeah. And the other author of the American History.
Katz, Jonathan Katz. K-A-T-Z, Berube. I don't know what nationality that is. Interesting. And this one's nice. And there's another fascinating book called The Celluloid Closet.
Vito Russo. Vito Russo.
Yes, by Vito Russo, R-U-S-S-O, which surveys the history of Hollywood and the hidden but incredible impact that gay culture has had on American society through the arts, and particularly film. Yes.
I just mentioned that the picture you gave of the antique world as being tolerant is being challenged quite a bit. It may have been, the situation may have been much worse than some literature would suggest. Bernadette Boudin is bringing out a book that deals with this, both in the Greek and in the Latin culture. There was a much more hostility than some of the surveys would suggest, especially when you move out of the aristocracy.
Which would be in line with Boswell's thesis that upper class urban culture is going to be more tolerant than folks, which is still true today.
We're having difficulty hearing you.
Okay, keep reminding me because I have to yell.
Let's ready to go on.
Okay. Yes?
This is the first session I've been to, so I may have missed it, but I would like some more history on the background of the word gay to designate male homosexual. I think it seems to me it destroys the original meaning of the word. And I would like to find a better, more positive word to use. I don't think
I can change it. Language is a living thing, and it emerges, and we dwell in it, and we also influence its change.
How long has that term been used in the country?
Like, at least since the 1840s. You know, the gay life. I mean, people left home and.
But the rise of the other gay kind of gay life. So it seems to me.
Yes.
We can all have a gay
I also think we're getting to a point now. I'm noticing that the more traditional use of the word gay, I'm seeing coming back. And I think, I think that has been a process of gay liberation, and that everybody, no one dared to use that word if homosexuals were claiming it. Mm-hmm. And now I'm starting to see it in, you know, like when I read The New Yorker or The Atlantic Monthly, I notice that writers are starting to use it again to mean whatever it means.
Maybe it's an awful we'll be able to be gay amidst our work and play again. From way back when I was there, it was that was the words, the song they changed.
Good example of homophobia.
Okay. It's onward.
Onward. So we can talk a little bit about what's emerging then in the gay lesbian community. A central tenet of all liberation theologies is we've heard about from the El Salvador folks about the preferential option for the poor and oppressed in the church. And another piece of that is the hermeneutical privilege of the poor and oppressed. Hermeneutics is the study of meaning in scripture. And it comes from the Greek god Hermes. He was the little guy with the wings on his feet who took the messages from the gods and goddesses to the people. How do we determine the message in the text? And this is a very simple concept. We hear, like last night in the concert, the Central American man saying, again, that liberation theology does not emerge from the theologians, but from the people, and then the theologians kind of codify it and put it down on paper. And it's a very simple concept that the people who wrote the Bible were poor and oppressed, whether it was under the oppression of Egypt or under the oppression of the rich people at the time of Amos or under the oppression of the Romans, and that there's a kind of natural simpatico. If these base communities in Central America simply read the text, how do they reflect on it? That there's going to be a resonance between the meaning of the text as it was written and how they talk about it, as opposed to characterize this meanly. Straight white European men, mostly dead now, who sat in their studies and told us all what it was supposed to mean. That gay and lesbian people, as oppressed people, also have a perspective on society that's different from other people, and that there's something of value in that, because we have a personal location which allows us a perspective into spirituality, religion, and society in general that, in addition to everybody else's, is a benefit to the whole. I just jotted down some things that I think are prominent. One is the concept of embodiment, which is a very important word in both feminism and gay liberation, whether it's within the church or without. And there's obvious parallels between embodiment and incarnation. Traditional Western religion has tended to split the intellect off from our feeling and body selves, so that at worst we focus on right teaching and dogma and inquisition, and not what it is to be a holistic, healthy person, which is what salvation means in the Greek. Salvo is the salve that we put on the wound to heal it. That's where salvation comes from. And this idea that the personal is political is a gay contribution to the latter half of the 20th century. That we have to talk about it because people's personal locations is where we really live out of. And if we're going to have a personal relationship with God, we experience that personally, not as a head trip, and not as authorized by authorities over us, but what's really happening in our lives. One of the things that's happening at Spirit of the Lakes is that as we move toward our second anniversary, we're seeing non-gay people coming, first out of curiosity, and then staying, and now joining. And it's a real interesting process because they have coming out stories, and we'll get to that in a minute, but there's been real things that have happened in their lives that they haven't felt comfortable sharing in their suburban church, that are part of their real lives. And so, because it's not approved, but it's their personal life, and they want a community of support to deal with that, and they're finding that in a gay, lesbian, spiritual community. Another important aspect, I'll just run through these and then we can talk about it, is an adamant distinction between spirituality and religion. that makes my job of proclaiming the gospel in the gay community challenging. But with this whole history, gay and lesbian people, personally and as a community, have a very critical view of religion as the oppressive force in Western society. And at the same time, spirituality is important to them, to us. So, for one thing, we see a lot of searching, also in non-gay women's movement. In terms of spirituality and alternative forms of spirituality, how that impacts the church, I think, is that, you know, how can we bring this to bear on the state of the church and theology today? What's the gospel? When we talk about gospel, we talk about the social context in which Jesus was living as a prophetic voice of a spirituality of relationship with the poor and oppressed, as opposed to a religion of legalism. And I truly believe that when gay and lesbian people are accepted in the church, a lot of other people are going to be like divorced people and incest victims, you know, on and on and on, are going to be in a much better place because we'll finally be communities of grace in which we can talk about our personal lives and find healing and through the love of Christ and so on and so forth. The dominant image and experience of gay people is called coming out. Like black culture, which has a particular, and generally speaking, has a particular kind of humor and has developed a particular language system to name and claim their experience. Gay and lesbian people also have a culture with the language coming out of the closet, coming out of that hidden life. Actually, though, which is how you mostly think about it, it appears to me, I hear it on TV now and stuff, but actually part of this humor is it's coming out at the debutante ball.
Yeah.
It's joining the community, it's joining the party, it's, it's coming out. And what coming out is starting to be honest and open about yourself, starting to develop your integrity, and you do that in a community of other people who have similar experience. So what gay and lesbian people share is not sex. It's the oppression that has come because of our sexual orientation. That's the solidifying point of the culture. That's the solidifying point of politics. That's the solidifying point of a theological discussion, which is very widespread and vital in the lesbian community. It's a conversion experience in which that involves that authority thing, like coming out is claiming my own experience. I'm not going to let the dominant society tell me that I need to hate myself anymore. I'm not going to let the dominant society tell me that God hates me and it's their responsibility to stone me to death. I'm not, you know, as the definition of Christianity, I'm not going to let the dominant culture tell me that incarnation in my life is impossible because I don't follow somebody else's rules. It's claiming that authority, and that's a conversion experience that I think is a very alive model for Christian conversion. It's not the same, but it's more vital and life-changing than confirmation class.
It's all moving, confirmation.
the process, one more thing in that coming, well, we're good transitioning here. The coming out process means that gay and lesbian community is very process oriented. And one of the culture shocks that I go through on a daily basis as I move in and out between gay, lesbian community and non-gay community, and here I would use straight, is how the two cultures relate to each other within their cultures. Mm-hmm. And when I'm in straight society and I'm at coffee hour or I'm here, coffee break or at a party or whatever, I notice the pattern is like, we talk about the weather, we talk about the weather some more. The distance is very important to keep that distance. You might, if you're feeling, if they seem to, you know, have a positive feeling about the weather, and so do you, and you might start revealing where you went to college. Okay. As opposed to in the gay community, where when gay and lesbian people meet, the first question is, tell me your coming out story. That's the first thing that happens. And you sit down and you say, you know, I grew up here, I grew up in this church, these were the influences of self-hatred in my life, these are the ways, this is how I was beat up in grade school and junior high and senior high and in church, and these are the ways I tried to cope. And then I went through my conversion experience, and now here's how I continue to grow and process into becoming a healthy, whole person in my spirituality and in my relationship and in my community. It means that gay and lesbian churches, and besides Spirit of Lex, there's an entire denomination of gay and lesbian people called the Metropolitan Community Churches, tend to be congregational meetings last a long time. We have to process everybody's feeling. We have to make sure that it's all very democratic and not hierarchical, and we have to come to consensus, and that takes a long time, but I think it's a real healthy process. And it reminds me of the name of Yahweh, which is I am what I am becoming. And that's a very different relational process theology kind of place to be at than God is this noun that we all have to live up to. And I think finally, something that's emerging is a theology of friendship. John, in the Roman, Lutheran, and Episcopalian traditions, authority and theology are defined in one way or another according to right teachings. But there's a whole other tradition that we associate with the Radical Reformation. The Congregationalists and the Mennonites and the Quakers, people like that, who don't base their structure or their theology on Peter's confession, whether it's Peter as the first pope or Peter's statement as the first dogmatic statement, but rather John 15:15, which Jesus says, I do not call you slaves, I call you friends. Because a slave doesn't know what his master is doing, but I have shared with all of you, and the Spirit is within you, and this is it's, and you're my friends. And that's the passage, as opposed to the Peter's confession. That's why Quakers call themselves friends. They're committed to that, and I think gay and lesbian community also has an entry point there in which we see the Spirit manifest in community. People who come to Spirit of the Lakes don't come out of habit. They don't come out of social pressure. They come because they have an extremely living faith that has survived depression, and they want to be there, and the spirit is very much alive. We've got, I've been thinking lately that a fundraising scheme for our church building fund could be. We're getting so many clergy who are coming out of curiosity, and then they come back. They're bringing their confirmation classes so that their kids can see what spirited worship is about. So I was thinking we could like invest in a bus and have spirit and brunch tours. So these are some of the things I'm seeing, and we can, I'll just open it up to questions and reflections.
Dan, you've made, and of course you have to, big generalizations about gay, lesbian, spirituality and religiosity. But I'm just curious if there are sort of dialects of that reflect people's backgrounds. So that if you went to Dignity, for example, would it be not significantly, but noticeably different than going to Metropolitan Community?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Could you say something about that? Maybe it's not important, except if people study religion professionally. Always want to know this thing. In which case, we can talk about it later.
Yeah. Well, there's some diversity within the community. I mentioned people who come from...
If people come out of the Roman tradition, are they more hierarchical?
They're not more hierarchical, because that's an important part of the gay experience, but they are more liturgical.
Okay.
So, Spirit of the Lakes, for example, which is, we started 20 months ago with 18 people, and now we've gone to 2 services. We have 700 people. Half of them are Lutherans and half of them are Catholics. So our religious experience is very liturgical.
Right, so you're more like
and a
little
than
the congregationalists in the UCC.
Yes. Whereas the Metropolitan Community Churches tend to be led by clergy and congregations of people from Baptist, Pentecostal kind of backgrounds, and their worship services reflect that.
So does their theology.
So does their theology. Dignity, we might see the end of soon. Their oppression has been so, in 1986, the Pope basically made a statement that gay and lesbian people deserve to be beat up on the street because we're sinful and unclean, we're perversions of nature, whatever, and then called on all Catholic dioceses to kick Dignity chapters out of there, which has been happening. As I said, like half the people at Spirit of Lakes are Dignity refugees who are, and the other half are Lutheran refugees who are leaving. And as the more there are alternatives there are, you know, the more depletion of those banks we're going to see. Because why spend all of your time and energy fighting when you can be in a normal environment? I mean, we don't. It's funny. It's been funny in this process of educational outreach as we approach this vote with the UCC. But people would say things like, "Well, what do you do there?" Like they were expecting, you know, pagan sacrifices. And the difference is that we just. I mean, we don't spend a whole lot of time, I mean, we don't spend much focus at all talking about gay and lesbian issues. But what's liberating is that we don't have to talk about it anymore. So we can finally get to the gospel as it relates to us. I mean, certainly our liturgy and our sermon illustrations would reflect our lives, but the point is it's the release from
being
doing
gone.
This all the time.
Do you do this, these sessions out away from Poland? It just seems like that you're more accepting here. Do you find that you get the same kind of response? I know that there were differences of opinion, but they were presented in rather a gentle way. I'm just wondering if that's your experience out outside of Oregon?
A lot of it depends on denominational background. Or at the time that Ruth and Phyllis were in Time magazine, approaching their ordination in San Francisco, the ministry of a class at Lutheran Northwestern called something like ministry.
Faith and ministry.
What?
Faith and ministry.
Okay, and cultural diversity. Called and asked me if I would speak to them about the ministry in the gay community, and the president of the seminary forbid that to happen. And then Ruth, who grew up on that campus because her father was a professor there for like 30 years, mm-hmm. asked to speak, and she also was forbidden to come on the campus. And so that is disturbing. It's disturbing to me.
When was that?
In March, about.
Oh, this year?
Yeah. Not only in terms of what you were asking before about invisibility, but it's very strange to me that a graduate school, which I would think not only is dedicated to studying the faith, but also freedom of inquiry, that the homophobia is that
but
extreme.
I agree. I think T.D. did a very strange thing, especially when he told Ruth that she couldn't come. But at the same time, they did have a whole day of...
Yeah, a weekend.
A whole weekend conference.
Yeah. It was really quite open.
That was,
yeah.
Was an ad.
Now planned by gay and lesbian people.
They participated in the plan.
Yeah.
No, I disagree, Tom, but I disagree.
Right, I just want to say that the situation there is a little more complicated than just forbidding Ruth to come up.
Yes, there was pressure applied. And.
But you're giving these talks outside the church as far as, you go out to the regular community and talk to groups other than
like
religious
groups. Well, also people from our church go, a little like sort of on the Mormon model.
Two by two.
And talk to like adult education classes and stuff.
By invitation.
By invitation. Yeah.
But there has to be some.
You don't have your own version of watchtower.
take equal times and hand it out to people.
What time's your thing tonight?
8:30.
Right after.
8:30.
I think it's 8:30.
Is it in here?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's in here.
Okay.
Thank you.